plants that were supposed to be cayennes, but they did not produce the smooth-skinned fruits he had known in South America. He could taste them now, and he imagined them being forced into cans cut to their size. He was haunted by this perfect pineapple, which he knew existed, but which lay beyond his reach, and he became obsessed with the idea of acquiring a bundle of mother plants. For a time, he considered a secret overland expedition from Paramaribo in Dutch Guiana, but discussions with geographers who knew the area convinced him that the intervening jungle was impenetrable. He tried suborning French colonial officials, but the government trusted its own subordinates no more than it trusted Whipple Hawksworth and checked them constantly, so that even though he poured some $20,000 worth of bribes into Guiana, he got no pineapple plants in return. And then one day, a lanky Englishman named Schilling rode up to Hanakai on a wobbly horse, dismounted and asked for a whiskey soda. "I believe I am the man you are looking for," Schilling said in clipped accents. "I don't need any more lunas," Whip replied, "and besides, you aren't husky enough." "I have no intention of working for a living," the lanky Englishman replied. "I have come to sell you something." "I can think of nothing that I require," Whip snapped. "I can think of something that you will want to pay a great deal of money for, Mr. Hawksworth." "What?" 2,000 prime cayenne crowns." As if his hand had frozen, Whip stopped pouring the whiskey. He made no pretense of not being interested, and his Adam's apple moved up and down in his dry throat. He put the whiskey bottle down, turned, and looked steadily at his visitor. "Cayenne?" he asked. "Prime crowns." "How?" "My father was a Dutchman before he became a British subject. He knows people in the Guianas." "Are the crowns vital?" "They're already growing in a hothouse in England." Wildly, Hawksworth grabbed the tall man's arm. "You're sure they're growing?" "I've brought a photograph," Schilling replied, and he produced a snapshot of himself standing inside a greenhouse with pineapples growing about his feet, and from the hearts of several of the plants rose incontestably the distinctive cayenne fruit. "Mr. Schilling," Whip began nervously. "Dr. Schilling, botanist. I'll sell you the cayennes, Mr. Hawksworth, but I want the job of raising them here in Hawaii." "A deal," Wild Whip agreed. "I'll send a special ship to pick them up. Can you keep them alive across the Atlantic and around the Horn?" "I'm a botanist," Dr. Schilling replied. While he waited for the Englishman's return, Wild Whip directed his feverish energy into laying out a special field to accommodate the 2,000 crowns that Schilling had contracted to deliver. And as he worked, he thought, "I'd like to find a man I could trust to care for these pineapples the way I'd do it." And he remembered the stocky Japanese field hand who had been willing to fight him over the matter of galvanized iron for the hot bath. "That's the kind of man I want," he mused, "someone with guts." He saddled his horse and rode out to the sugar fields until he spotted Kamajiro. "Hey, you one fella," he shouted. "You speak me?" the rugged little Japanese asked with a friendly grin. "How you like work, boss man, one field?" And the compact was sealed. Now Kamajiro ran each morning from the camp to till the pineapple field, pulverizing the earth with his hands. And each night he ran back to tend his hot bath. Wild Whip, seeing him always in a hurry, thought, "That one does the work of three men," and he raised his pay to 75 cents a day. Under Whip's direction, Kamajiro plowed the land to a depth of 2 feet, and when its rich redness lay in the sunlight, Whip was pleased, for books had told him that above all else the pineapple required iron, and Kauai was practically solid iron. Every 3 months the field was turned again, and special guano fertilizers were introduced to make it productive. Ditches were dug completely around the area to draw off unnecessary water, and a windbreak of wild plum and casuarina was planted to ward off any chance salt spray. Few brides have ever had homes arranged for them with the meticulous care that Wild Whip exercised in building this all-important seedbed. When it was done, he stood in the middle of its finely aerated soil and shouted to Kamajiro, "Bimbai all fields up there, pineapple, eh?" And he pointed in all the upland directions as far as he could see, for he intended them all to be crowded with cayenne plants, 4,000 to the acre, and the money that he had so far made growing sugar would turn out to have been children's coins for playing store. The first crop of cayennes surpassed Whip's hopes. Dr. Schilling proved himself both a botanist and a dipsomaniac, and from the front room of the Hanakai Mansion, which he obviously intended never to leave, the tall Englishman directed the successful propagation of the plants that were to revolutionize the Hawaiian economy. Of the first 2,000 cayennes which had been abducted from the fields of French Guiana, nearly 1,900 grew to luscious maturity. And these first pineapples were an astonishment to the citizens of Hawaii. Whip, as was his custom, gave the fruit away and told everyone, "Start tilling your upland fields now. Gold is about to drip out of them in a fragrant flow." A pineapple plant produces slowly, only one fruit at the end of 2 years. Technically, it is a cirrhosis or bundle of fruits, each of the composite squares being the result of a separate flower. But when the fruit is matured, the plant offers four separate ways of propagating new plants. The crown of the pineapple fruit can be carefully torn off and planted. Slips that have started growing from the base of the fruit can be lifted off and planted. Suckers that have begun to spring out from the base of the plant can be used in the same way. Or the stump itself can be cut up into chunks and planted like potatoes. From each surviving plant, Dr. Schilling was thus able to recover one crown, three or four slips, two or three suckers, and two or three stump sections. By 1910, the pineapple industry was established in Hawaii. But in 1911, it was overtaken by disaster, for the fields which Wild Whip had so carefully prepared stopped nourishing the plants, and they began to turn a sickly yellow. In panic, Whip commanded Dr. Schilling to sober up and find out what was happening. But the drunken Englishman could not focus on the problem, so Whip stormed through the mansion, which he now shared with Schilling, and smashed all bottles containing alcohol. Then Dr. Schilling pulled himself together and spent some time in the fields. "I must make some experiments," he reported, and a corner of the mansion was given over to test tubes and beakers. But all Schilling was doing was using fresh pineapples for the distillation of a superfine grade of alcohol, which he liked better than whiskey, and he was soon incommunicado. Wild Whip solved this impasse by beating the Englishman into insensibility, then throwing him into a cold bath. Apparently others had treated Schilling in this manner, for he took no great offense, shivering in the tub and whimpering like a child. "By God," Hawksworth shouted, "you brought these plants here and you'll find out what's wrong with them." He dressed the gawky scientist, put his shoes on, and personally led the shaky man into the fields. "What's wrong with those plants?" he stormed. "Look, Brother Hawksworth, you can't stand there and command me to find out what's happened. The human mind doesn't work that way." "Yours will," Hawksworth roared. "Suppose I start to walk down that path and down that road and never look at these plants again. Then what?" "Then by the time you get to the road, Dr. Schilling, you can't walk because both your legs are broken." "I believe you would," the shaken Englishman said. "You bet I would," Whip growled. "Now get to work." He stood back, stared in shock, and yelled, "Now what in hell are you doing?" "I'm tasting the soil," Dr. Schilling replied. "Oh, for Christ's sake," Whip snorted and left. It took Dr. Schilling 4 weeks to make up his mind about the pineapple plants, and when he reported to his employer, it was obvious that he himself scarcely believed his own conclusions. "This is extraordinary, Brother Hawksworth, and you won't believe it, but those plants are starved for iron." "Ridiculous," Hawksworth stormed. He was sick and tired of this infuriating Englishman, and was at last ready to throw him off the plantation. No, Dr. Schelling replied soberly. I'm convinced that they are about to die for lack of iron. That's preposterous, Hawksworth stormed. This goddamn island is practically solid iron. Look at the soil, man. It's iron, that's true, Schelling agreed. But I'm afraid it must be iron in some form that the plants cannot use. How can they stand in solid iron and not be able to use it? That, Schelling said, is why the universe will always be a mystery. Are you fooling with me? Hawksworth asked ominously. Who would dare? Schelling replied. What do you want us to do? Hawksworth asked quietly. I want to sprinkle iron in a different kind of solution over these plants. No, it's totally preposterous. You get back out there and find out what's really wrong. It's iron, Schelling said stubbornly. How can you be sure? I can taste it. Have you run any tests on it? No, I don't have to. Well, run some tests. No, don't. You'd just distill yourself some more alcohol. What kind of iron do you want? Iron sulfate. As a result of this decision, in late 1911, Kamijiro Sakagawa marched through the experimental fields of the Hanakai pineapple plantation, lugging a bucket of spray, which he directed onto the yellow leaves of the perishing plants. And as he passed, the solution of sulfate of iron ran down the narrow leaves and penetrated to the red soil about the roots. As if by magic, the sickly plants began to revive, and within 4 days the yellow leaves were returning to their natural color. The Cayennes were saved. And when it was proved, as Dr. Schelling suspected, that they had been standing in iron yet starving for iron, Wild Whip joyously gathered up an armful of ripe fruit and tossed it onto the mansion floor. "Brew yourself some alcohol and stay drunk as long as you like," he commanded. Sometimes Kamijiro, running to work and running back to tend his hot bath, would not see the tall Englishman for weeks at a time. And then, as he cut the lawn, he would find Schelling in a basket chair by the side of the cliff, staring down at the play of surf as it struck the opposite rocks. Schelling was a surprising man, a drunken, besotted individual who could think. One day, when he was driving into Kapaa with Whip in one of the first cars on Kauai, he spotted a junkyard and said, "You ought to buy that, Brother Hawksworth." "That junk? Why?" "You're paying a lot of money for iron sulfate, and that's what it is. Rusty junk to which sulfuric acid has been applied." So Whip bought the junkyard and launched an iron sulfate factory. And in later years, when automobiles had become numerous, he bought all the old wrecks on Kauai for $4 each, piled them up, drenched them with gasoline, and burned away the rubber and the horsehair. When what was left had rusted, he treated the junk with sulfuric acid and remarked, "Everyone who eats pineapple is eating the handiwork of Henry Ford, God bless him." But in the growing of pineapple, which brought hundreds of millions of dollars into the territory, when one problem was licked, the next arose. For apparently the Cayenne did not enjoy growing in Hawaii and fell prey to one disaster after another. When the iron problem was solved, the mealybug arose, and once more the industry seemed doomed. The ugly, louse-like little bugs were moved from place to place by ants who tended them like milk cows, living off their sweet, nutritious exudations. Particularly, the mealybugs loved pineapple, whose growth they destroyed, and it seemed an act of conscious malevolence when millions of ants hiked several miles to deposit their cows upon the precious pineapples. Dr. Schelling studied the problem for several months, while field after field of Wild Whip's choicest cayennes wilted and died from the infestation. Then he hit upon a dual solution which halted the mealybugs. Around each field, he planted decoy rows of pineapple, and these intercepted the mealybugs and kept them from invading the productive areas. And around the entire field, he laid long boards soaked repeatedly in creosote, and these fended off the ants and their ugly cows. After this victory over the little lice, he subsided into a year-long lethargy of drunkenness, awaiting the next disaster. It came when Whip's canning manager reported, "Because the cayennes are so big, we can't fit them into the cans and waste 40% of the fruit trimming them down to can size." "What in hell do you want me to do?" Whip snarled, wearied by the constant battle to keep his fields productive. "What we've got to have is smaller cayennes," the manager explained. So Wild Whip stormed back to Hanukkah, shook his English expert into reasonable sobriety, and said, "Dr. Schilling, you've got to make the pineapples smaller." Through a golden haze that had been accumulating for 13 months, the scraggly Englishman said, "The mind of man can accomplish anything. Draw me the pineapple you want." Whip went back to the canning manager, and together they drew on paper the specifications of the perfect pineapple. It had to be sufficiently barrel-shaped to leave a good rim of fruit when the core was cut out. It had to be juicy, acid, sweet, small, without barbs on the leaves, solid and golden in color. With a ruler and French curves, the two men constructed the desired fruit. And when Whip thrust the paper at Schilling, he said, "That's what we want." Schilling, glad to have an alternative to drunkenness, replied, "That's what you'll get." He inspected every pineapple field on Kauai, comparing the available fruit against the ideal image. And whenever he found something close to the printed specifications, he marked that plant with a flag. And after 4 years of this infinitely patient work, he announced, "We have built the perfect pineapple." When he delivered the first truckload to the cannery, the manager was ecstatic. "Our problems are over," he said. "Until the next one," Schilling replied. In 1911, a woman writer from New York who had once stayed in Honolulu 4 weeks wrote a rather scurrilous book about Hawaii in which she lamented three things: the influence of the missionaries, who had maliciously killed off the Hawaiians by dressing them in Mother Hubbards; the criminality of companies like Janders and Whipple, who had imported Orientals; and the avarice of missionary descendants, like those in Hawksworth and Hale, who had stolen the lush lands of Hawaii. After her book had created something of a sensation throughout America, she returned to the islands and in triumph came to Kauai, where at a splendid polo tournament she was presented to Wild Whip Hawksworth. His team had just defeated Honolulu, and he was flushed with victory and should have been in a gracious mood. But as he was introduced to the lady author, he thought he understood who she was and asked coldly, "Are you the good lady who wrote Hawaii's Shame?" "Yes," she replied proudly, "I am," for she was accustomed to being fawned over. "What did you think of it?" "Ma'am," Whip said, carefully placing his polo mallet on a rack lest he be tempted to use it in an unorthodox manner, "I thought your book was complete bullshit." The polo players and their ladies recoiled from Whip's savage comment, and some began to offer the startled lady their apologies. But Whip interrupted. "No, there will be no apologies. Stand where you are, ma'am, and look in every direction. Whatever you see was brought into these islands by men like me. The sugar upon which our economy rests, my grandfather Whipple, a missionary, brought that in. The pineapples, I'm the grandson of missionaries, and I brought them in. The pine trees, the royal palms, the tulip trees, the avocados, the wild plum, the crotons, the house, and the horses. We brought them all in. The Hawksworth mango, best fruit in the world, is named after me. And as for the Orientals, hey, Kamajiro, you come, eh? This bandy-legged little man has done more work in Hawaii. He's built more, and he will continue to build more than a dozen of the people you were wailing about. I brought him in here, and I'm proud of it. I'm only sorry he doesn't intend to stay. Now, ma'am, if you have any more questions about Hawaii, I'd be glad to answer 'em. Because I hope you'll go home and write another book, and this time not be such a horse's ass." He bowed and left her gagging. In Honolulu, of course, his polo field speech, as it was termed, was a momentary sensation. since, as one of the Hale women explained, if one were picking a man to defend the missionaries, he would hardly pick Wild Whip. He and his drunken English friend lived on at Hanakai with fairly frequent visits to the brothels at Kapa'a. At the Cliffside Mansion, he entertained a good deal, and in his leisurely talks over brandy, he began to expound the first coherent theory of Hawaii. What I visualize is an island community that treasures above all else its agricultural lands. On them, it grows bulk crops of sugar and pineapple and ships them to the mainland in H&H ships. With the money we get, we buy the manufactured goods our people need, things like iceboxes, automobiles, finished lumber, hardware, and food. Thus, the ships go one way loaded and come back loaded. That's the destiny of Hawaii, and anyone who disturbs that fine balance is an enemy of the islands. He was willing to identify the enemies of Hawaii. Anyone who tampers with our shipping ought to be shot. Anyone who tries to talk radical ideas to our field hands ought to be run off the islands. Anyone who interferes with our assured supply of cheap labor from Asia strikes a blow at sugar and pineapple. Once he confided, H&H have run the ships cheaply and faithfully. I see no reason why any radical changes are required. And I think you must admit that J&W have run the plantations well. Nobody can lodge a complaint against them. As long as these two firms continue to serve the islands justly, it seems to me the welfare of Hawaii is assured. And for outsiders like that goddamn woman author to go around raising a lot of questions is downright ingratitude. In 1912, the campaign for president on the mainland grew rather warm, and for the first time in some years, Democrats felt that they had a good chance of sending their man, Woodrow Wilson, to the White House. Of course, citizens of Hawaii could not vote for the national offices. But in the island elections, a few pathetic Democrats began to parrot the optimism existing on the mainland, and one misguided liberal even went so far as to appear before a mass meeting of six in the nearby town of Kapa'a. Out of sheer curiosity over a human being who dared to be a Democrat in Hawaii, Wild Whip insinuated himself as the seventh listener, and stood appalled as the man actually sought votes for his party. There is a new spirit abroad in America, a clean, sharp wind from the prairies, an insistent voice from the great cities. Therefore, I propose to do something that has never before been done in these islands. I, a Democrat and proud of the fact, am going to visit each of the sugar and pineapple plantations to explain in my words what the ideas of Woodrow Wilson and his adherents mean. Tell your friends that I'll be there. In some agitation, Wild Whip rode home and carefully took down all the firearms he kept at Hanakai. Inspecting each, he summoned his lunas and said, "I just heard a Democrat say he was coming here to address our workmen. If he steps 6 inches onto Hanakai, shoot him." One of the lunas who had been through high school asked deferentially, "But doesn't he have the right to speak?" "Right," Whip thundered. "A Democrat have the right to step onto my plantation and spread his poison? My God, I say who shall come here and who shall not. This is my land, and I'll have no alien ideas parading across it." Lunas in 1912 were not apt to be easily frightened, and this one stuck to his guns. But if this man is a spokesman for one of the political parties... "Von Schlemm," Whip roared in profound amazement, "I'm astonished at such talk from you.